Welcome back to the Now Age podcast with me, Ruby Warrington. This week's episode is deep and real and important, and it features a conversation with a woman named Kristen Farmer. I first read about Kristen and her story in an article on Vice, and I knew right away that I wanted to speak with her and to share her story. Kristen is the founder of an organization called Birthing Beautiful Communities, which is a grassroots team of doulas and women trained in perinatal support who provide education and support to expecting African-American mothers. Based out of Cleveland, Ohio, in Kristen's community, 7 black babies die for every 1 white baby. Nationally, African-American women are affected by infant death 3 times more than the national average. To me, these simple facts are an incredibly powerful illustration of the everyday human impact of institutionalized racism in the United States. It's not like we aren't already being made aware of this all the time, with stories of police brutality and other acts of white supremacist violence in the news. But Kristen's story really brings home how racial inequality is something that begins at birth, at conception even. And her approach is to begin to address this from birth too. There are numerous factors playing into this whole equation, which Kristen explains in our conversation. And one thing among many that I really admire about her approach is that she just exudes the belief that when we work together, we really can begin to overcome some of the seemingly most deeply rooted problems that we face as a society. I'm so inspired by this woman, her work, and her attitude, and I know you will be too. In this episode, we discuss the human impact of African-American culture having been built on trauma, the manifestation of this legacy and how we as a society can begin to acknowledge and address this, how cultural attitudes shaped by racial oppression directly impact negative birth outcomes, the power of sisterhood when women commit to supporting one another's growth, the importance of giving people the tools to facilitate their own healing, why we need to think about equity as a verb meaning to apply an abundance of opportunities and resources to communities that have historically been deprived of these things, and why social interconnectedness is essential for cultivating the vulnerability required to heal. Like I said, this conversation is rich and deep and incredibly inspiring. If you can, please take time to listen extra closely and also pay attention to what it brings up in you. So Kristen, thank you again so much for joining me today. I'm really excited to speak to you. And I'm wondering if you could just begin in your own words, telling us what you do with Birthing Beautiful Communities.
Hi, so my name is Kristen Farmer, and I am the founding president and CEO of Birthing Beautiful Communities located in Cleveland, Ohio, where there is a very high infant mortality rate, particularly amongst African-American babies. For every 1 white baby that dies in our county, 7 African-American babies die in our county. And we are a group of women who support expecting mothers or new mothers and their partners in the preconception stage, if need be, at the prenatal and prenatal care stage, at the labor and delivery as doulas, and postpartum through the baby's first year of life. And within that scope of time, we provide holistic services to the families around maternal mental health, housing, workforce development, entrepreneurship, and business development for those interested in that, and also as liaisons for those within the justice system. So we become sisters and friends, and there's a village of us. We have 20 women on staff. All the women are part-time independent contractors with an administrative team. And they're there to fully support the mothers and the families with the support classes that we have, the SOS circles, Sisters Offering Support, which is aimed at anxiety, depression, panic, and fear to address trauma and those things. that could impact whether or not that mother can make it to full term within her pregnancy. So we are a support system.
You're more than a support system, it sounds like to me. I mean, this is like such an incredible mission that you are helming here. Just the depth and breadth of the services that you provide is really so, so impressive. I think you only started in 2015, is that right?
Yes, that is correct. That's when we officially started as a team.
And there's such a breadth to what you do, and it's such a holistic approach, which is, I think, one of the things that seems so impactful to me, I suppose. Like you've really considered kind of every possible angle and are aiming to provide support for people at every stage in the journey of birthing new life.
Yes, with the reality that we are whole people and we can't just fix pieces and parts of ourselves. We can commit to evolving, ever changing and growing, but there's not a one size fits all. You know, things have to be customized for particular communities, for particular people. But then that support has to be provided in those areas, and where there is a deficit that maybe a family is in for a particular child, for example, then there should be a village of people who can fulfill that need because there's no fault of the child itself. So we just have to be collectively responsible for one another. And that's what our mission is really built around, is healing one another and being supportive,
which is a beautiful mission and message actually for everybody of every walk of life, but then becomes particularly important when your community is facing the kind of challenges that you described with some of those statistics in the beginning. I want to go back to that in a little bit, but I'd really love to hear why you, Kristen, are doing this. Why is this your mission, and what actually led you personally into this path?
Well, I have always taken a keen interest in pregnancy and childbirth for as long as I can remember. But when I was 16, I can remember watching a reality show that was about midwives and birthing centers. And so I fell in love with the idea of catching babies. I just thought that it was it was amazing. I just thought that the human body is amazing, and just how we reproduce. I just have always just loved it, and babies, newborn babies in particular. So my mission in life was to become a midwife and to open a birthing center in Cleveland. That was my 16-year-old self saying that. And I went off to college as a nursing major. And my goal again was to become a nurse midwife, and it didn't quite turn out that way. I had some issues. I was like the first generation college student in my family, and so I was just sort of getting used to the climate and it being college. And so I ended up switching my major a few times, but then I became pregnant. And when I became pregnant, I was in my third year of college, and I was very nervous about how I was going to navigate motherhood and continue my education. But the thing that saved me was the support that I had there. I didn't live near my family. I was an hour away from my family, but my friends, we all live very close by to one another. And so they helped me with my baby. And that was how I was able to finish. I was able to finish after a year. He was a year old, I believe, when I graduated. So that support and that village was very important, you know, to my success. And there's so many women who lack that support. And so I wanted to provide some sort of space around sisterhood. Because I think sometimes there's a stigma with women, and Black women in particular, about us being able to get along. And it was important for me to show that women do get along. and they can get along. And this is how well we get along, that we support one another and support one another's growth. So sort of my passion around pregnancy and childbirth and the ability to bring life into this world, coupled with the sisterhood or the need for sisterhood that I saw within my community in particular. And then some of the issues that Black women in particular were facing around health disparities. And I quickly realized earlier on that a lot of this was due to the stressors in their lives. And then there was not enough support to assist. And then those things led to other things, such as behavioral issues, alcoholism, drug abuse, and, you know, could leave you in a position to where you have to abandon your kids, even though that's not what you wanted to do. You just had no one to go to or no one there to support you to help you work through your issues.
That was it's such a beautiful answer. And you used the, you know, you've mentioned a few times the word village. And we hear, I think, a lot, you know, it takes a village, and people kind of like almost just say that as a throwaway phrase. And I think so rarely do we actually, in modern societies, in modern communities, particularly in urban communities, city communities, do we experience that true sense of community, which is what you're describing to me. Mm-hmm. And it also seems to me like when there are stresses which are personality-based, internal, family-based, and then the very external stresses of existing in a system that is designed to oppress you, for example. Mm-hmm. And it seems like those kind of stresses can then manifest as much more dangerous or difficult kind of symptoms, health symptoms, when there is a lack of that community support. And that actually when the community support comes in place, a person who's experiencing these kind of stresses can feel that they have the support, they're getting the strength to kind of overcome some of what they're being faced with. Is that a part of what you're doing? Is that part of what you've experienced?
Absolutely. It is giving people the tools and the skills that they need to navigate through life. And if you miss that, if no one taught you that, if no one was there to give you that, then you have difficulties going through life. Everything is a challenge. And so without being equipped with that, then you start to harbor a lot of anger because you feel trapped in your situation because you don't have the tools. And that is what's the manifestation of that, for example, is community violence. So it's just these things that African-American people in particular are sitting with, because our entire existence in this country has been of a traumatic nature. Our culture is embedded in trauma. We don't know anything other than trauma, because that is what history has shown us and has taught us. From the moment Africans stepped foot off of Africa, it was a traumatic experience. And what we see today is just a manifestation of those things, because those things have not been accepted in our society. Those things have not been acknowledged in our society. And so that causes oppression, because there's you feel as if you don't have a fighting chance. And then people are unable to speak up, you know, because it becomes their norm. And there's just nothing there to support people who have been through such trauma. And there's no coincidence that African Americans fare not very well in a lot of areas. There are health disparities, wealth disparities, disparities in the workplace and employment, unemployment, education, the justice system, you name it. So instead of society looking at this as being an issue of what is wrong with our society, what is causing this, we as a society point the finger at those people who have not been healed from trauma.
Mm. Who, as you say, are simply almost living out symptoms of that unhealed trauma that are manifesting as violent, self-destructive behavior, disparate communities, etc.
Yeah. Black infant mortality is just a symptom of a much larger problem.
Mm. There was another statistic I read that, just to give some kind of idea of like the scale and the scope, but as it relates to childbirth and pregnancy, that Black mothers are 243% more likely to die of pregnancy or child-related causes than white women in the US, which is just such a huge disparity. And again, a very, very human insight, like a really raw human insight into the actual impact of systemic racism and the unhealed trauma that is a result of that racist system. What do you think? I mean, what are the reasons for this kind of the actual physical issues that women are facing?
Well, for one, you know, and I think this example has been used a lot, you know, with Serena Williams and other, you know, wealthy Black women say the same thing, that, you know, we aren't being listened to, right? Our pain is our threshold for pain is perceived to be higher, which is why the opiate crisis affects white America versus it affecting Black America. You know, it's because if we were in pain, no one listened to us anyway. And so they didn't give you the drugs. So in that case, it fared. It, you know, that worked in favor of Black America. But the truth is, you know, these things are very hard for people to come to terms with because our society hasn't acknowledged our history. And so, and you have to start there. You know, one of the things that I say too is that here in America, you know, back in March, we took our clients, a group of our clients, to Washington, D.C. to go to the Smithsonian Museum, the African American, the National, I think it's the National Museum of African American History and Culture. And it's a new museum. And the first thing we noticed as we're going to the square is a Holocaust museum and memorial, which in major cities you see all the time, which I think that that's great because that teaches the history of where people were at a time so that that doesn't repeat itself and that we are honoring those who lost their lives. But slavery actually occurred here on this soil and we don't acknowledge it. We don't have, that museum was 50 years in the making. You know, so why is something that is such a part of our history and our existence being muffled, you know, and told that that was a long time ago? And The Nation published a article 2 years ago that said that African Americans are 228 years behind in wealth. And I use that in each of my presentations. So who has 228 years
to catch up, right?
To catch up. Yeah. So the only thing that equity means, equity, I have my own definition of equity. Equity used as a verb, as in an action. The only definition I see for equity is supplying an abundance of resources and opportunities to communities and populations that have been historically and consistently deprived of those opportunities and resources. That is the only definition of equity. Because that is the only thing that could restore balance in a society where we're 228 years behind in wealth. our Black mothers are 243% more likely to die. In New York and in Texas, Black mothers are 12 times more likely to die than the national rate. In some neighborhoods in Cleveland, Ohio, where I live and do this work, 6 times the national rate for infant death.
They're really staggering figures. And I think what you talk about when you talk about equity is really about, and this kind of acknowledgement that there is a rebalancing that has to happen, and an acknowledgement of the pain and the trauma that's being carried on from generation to generation, will help people to understand that, yes, I have experienced pain, and it's okay. And if I ask, and if I talk about that, and if I ask for help with that, I will receive that help, because otherwise there seems like there's this, this kind of sense that, well, even if I ask for help, or even if I call out my pain, no one's going to listen. No one's going to hear me. No one's going to help me. So just this kind of continuum of despair then sets in, which again results in all these sorts of symptoms, which can be physical, which can be emotional, mental, etc.
And the other issue too is the lack of representation of African American providers in those spaces. You know, here within, you know, our city, we have 3 practicing Black midwives, who I know of, who that actually catch babies. And there was a time when Black women dominated midwifery. You know, certainly during slavery, and certainly thereafter, Black women play a huge role in the history of childbirth, child rearing, breastfeeding, wet nurses, all of these things. So to get to a place to where we have the lowest percentage of midwives working in our country, there's been a lot of barriers to that. And if you are 228 years behind in wealth, there you're likely to be the minority.
And I want to speak more about how this, the idea of, I think the healing from trauma piece is something that we talk about on the platform a lot, and the idea of, you know, the fact that generational trauma is carried on from generation to generation. And I think that the way you're describing this showing up in the literal childbearing, childbirthing, child rearing process is a really kind of literal illustration of how generational wounds can be passed down. I wonder if you could speak to the sort of symbolism in that process. You know, this is a very, you're talking about birthing beautiful communities, and that seems like it has multiple meanings within that, you know?
Yeah, well, to speak to the midwives and sort of the imagery and how passing that down generational, I always say that there are 3 types of trauma I believe that African Americans are dealing with at any given time, and one of them is generational trauma. And we see that manifest in different ways. So for example, Black women have the lowest breastfeeding rates in the country, right? That could be from generational wounds, right? We say that too, as we're, when did breastfeeding become a stigma? When Black women were breastfeeding not only their babies, but the babies of their masters, their slave masters, and their wives, right? So how did this idea that breastfeeding is not good or not healthy, or, you know, is not the best way, that has a lot to do with that, you know, over the years and generations, because then breastfeeding was linked to being poor.
I see.
You know? And so then that takes its toll too. Like, oh no, we can afford formula, right? If you breastfed, you were poor. So there are a lot of these generational connections. Also with, you know, abandonment, there's a generational, with that, with the emotional connection or emotional detachment between mother and baby. Because in slavery, a lot of Black women who had given birth did not want to get emotionally attached to their babies who they knew would be sold. So those are very deep wounds that have manifested themselves into what we see today. Even the way Black men were treated, are treated, that takes another toll, because without those men around, that then puts a lot of stress and strain on the mother. And there's a link between mass incarceration and female head of households. So we know that Black men are disproportionately affected by mass incarceration. And without the fathers, brothers, uncles there to support the family as a whole, that then creates a stressful and chaotic environment for the mother who now has to work two or three jobs and doesn't have that support or that village around her.
And then for the young children growing up without secure masculine role models around, there becomes more chaos and kind of instability within the communities at large.
It's an imbalance. It's just the imbalance. I mean, even in spiritual work, the masculine energy, the feminine energy, you know, the yin and the yang, just the balance, right? Anytime whatever it is, the pH balance, however you want to describe it, is just when things are in balance, that's what we see. That's, you know, a manifestation of that imbalance is what we see in disparities.
Absolutely. And I think going back to that idea of like the symbolism of birthing being almost a literal kind of like visual representation of that idea of how these beliefs, I suppose, that stem from traumatized kind of communities and the behaviors that kind of the coping mechanisms that kind of came up to as a result of those traumas, how those beliefs are then kind of like instilled again and passed on yet again to the next generation. And I think what I find to be so impactful, you know, I mentioned this before we started recording, but I really think there are two kinds of activism. There's the very kind of like loud protests, banners out in the street, demanding change from the top down, which is super important to bring these causes into real like visibility. And then there's the kind of activism, which is literally working human to human on the ground to heal one person at a time so that the new generations coming through can actually be empowered or have the self-belief even to choose differently when it comes to their families, when it comes to their lives, when it comes to the ways that the communities that they're building. So I wonder if you can just, I'd love to hear your kind of thoughts about doing that kind of work, the importance actually of doing this very kind of what's often seen as women's work, I suppose, because it's perhaps got a more kind of caretaking or nurturing element to it. If you could speak to what you see as the importance of that kind of work as activism.
I think that you're, I think you're absolutely right. The other side to the work that we do, our internal process is extremely important as well too, because all of the women, they come in and they make a livable wage. They all start off making $20 per hour, and they're paid a flat rate of $500 per birth. So I intentionally created that way to create equity. Because there's no way that the women can support other women when they themselves are struggling. And so that's where we get so much wrong when it comes to programs and the people who are on the ground. They don't get paid much money. And if you are expecting for people to help other people who are broken in the same area, it won't work. You know, so this is also economic development. That's a part of our model. We are equity in action, pretty much. We are showing what equity actually looks like in action. And so all of the women, they work part-time, so they're flexible within their schedule. We take care of 90% of the benefits. The women can bring their children and their babies to work with them, so they are not choosing between being a parent and being an employee. And it just makes for the most productive work environment, because there we are all, they're supporting one another while we are supporting other women. And so, again, it really does become this village, because when the birth worker gets with her client, the client not only has her, what we call our workers, perinatal support professionals, but that mom not only has the perinatal support professional that she was assigned, but she also gets all of us, because we have 3 to 4 classes per week. We provide transportation. We remove any barriers that the mother may be facing. We have a room for the children so that the mother can focus on her healing. We provide dinner. And we really treat this like a family, you know. And so the women, they stay with us even after they leave our program. In fact, the moms had got together and they had created their own extension, a postpartum program for themselves, because they wanted to continue to be with one another afterward. These were women that they met, you know, during the time they were with us. And so again, that social interconnectedness is so important. And without that, you are just really going in circles. Now, I work from the top down as well, because I don't do direct service anymore. So all of my work is around, you know, administration and sustainability. And I do a lot of presentations and talks around structural and systemic racism and equity and how some of these things can be implemented and what, you know, some of the institutions can do. What can the educational institutions do to foster equity in their institutions? What can the school systems do to foster equity? You know, so all of these things have an impact on birth outcomes. It's not just about the birth. It's about the experience that the mother and the father who created this child, it's about their experiences. Because of the death of an infant is the bottom of the barrel. That's as bad as it gets. So what has come before that has led up to that? So the experiences that the mother and the father have, so if they are unemployed or if they are really stressed out at their job that they're working at in corporate America because they can't move up, or, you know, they're being harassed by the police, or, you know, things specifically that African Americans go through. So if those are the experiences of the parents, that automatically trickles down to through to the mother, to the baby. Even in utero. So the leading cause of infant death is prematurity. Our work is all around figuring out what is leading Black women into early labor more than any other group in this country.
And what do you think it is?
Well, it is the stress. It's toxic stress. It's that constant high level of cortisol that creates a weathering effect on the body, according to Dr. Angela Neal Barnett, who is the psychologist and professor at Kent State University, and she works with us on the stress piece of our program. The sisters offering support. So she creates the circles and the interventions to gives the women the tools and the skills that they need to navigate that when they feel stress, specifically anxiety, panic, depression, and fear. And women love that program. It's actually mandatory for any mother coming in our doors.
And this also goes back to this idea of sisterhood and creating an actual community of genuine, loving support for a mother, but for any woman or any human actually who's experiencing these high levels of stress, you know? And you said something as well when we began talking about this idea of sisterhood, the idea that women being, having traditionally, and particularly Black women having been traditionally kind of pitted against each other, this kind of competition being there or this kind of rivalry in a way. I mean, I often think, and in fact, in my first book, I kind of talk about how I believe that actually this has been a part of the, this has been built into the systems of oppression that we all actually find ourselves living in. You know, the idea of actually separating women from each other, creating this divisiveness between women, erodes the incredible power to heal, to support each other, to build solid structures and communities of almost self-governance that can occur when women really do come together in sisterhood. And I'm wondering how you go about fostering this sisterhood within your organization. Like, what are the kind of steps that you have women go through to really kind of bond in this very powerful way?
Well, I would say that we demonstrated the stat. We walk it how we talk it, so to speak, right? We gather amongst ourselves. We have our own sister circles. And most importantly, upon becoming employed with us, I have every lady sign a sisterhood agreement that I created with 5 principles. That are around respect, ensuring the sisterhood. You know, we talk if there's any issues, you know, so, and that is our, that's our will and testament, our sisterhood agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And so we demonstrate what it looks like to be in support of another and to allow others to support us. Because again, in the African-American culture is different. You know, we are stereotyped in certain ways. And Dr. Angela talks about this within her presentations about the SOS circle that she created. You know, we are often looked at as the sassy one, or, you know, someone with an attitude. But even if it is an attitude, it's stress. It's not exactly an attitude. It's, you know, but it all leads back or comes from stress. You know, or someone looking at you like a video vixen and this. So Black women have been stereotyped in such ways that creates stress within itself, and the unrealistic expectations that people have of you, you end up neglecting yourself. And you can't take care of anyone else if you can't take care of yourself. So you essentially do come first. And so that's what we sort of teach the women, like, it's okay to be selfish, because if you don't feel whole, then it's what you can give to your children is limited. You know, what you can give to your partner is limited. So you have to take care of you first. And that allows you to take care of the people around you if you so choose to. And that's another, you know, thing, boundaries. And so, you know, again, we talk to and teach the women about skills, life skills, how to survive life 101.
Ask for help. One of them, right?
Yeah, so what are the tools and skills that you need to navigate this world? And again, it's all cultural intervention. It's saying that, look, we are acknowledging our traumatic past, we are healing from it, and we are growing onward and upward.
Tell me then a little bit more about this I'm really interested, and I've been having conversations with a lot of different people about how humans really heal from trauma. What are your views on that, the actual process of healing from trauma that you've witnessed in your work?
Mm-hmm. I think even, you know, personal too, a lot of my work, this work that I do is of a very personal nature to me. You know, I've witnessed these things, gone through, experienced these things, is which why I can speak to them and create a model around this, even, mm-hmm. you know, with our organization. I think that, you know, in healing, the first thing you have to do is acknowledge that the trauma has happened and is there. We spend a lot of time in denial. We spend a lot of time denying our mistakes, which we would do so much better if we actually acknowledge them, you know. And it's this quote I love that says, we would learn a lot from our mistakes if we were not so busy denying them. Mm. And that's true. We spend so much time denying it that we don't get to acknowledge it and then accept it. And then once we get to accepting, then that's where the real work begins. And, you know, it's a process. And that's another thing. We're a very impatient society. We want everything to be ready and done and there, but the healing, it doesn't work like that. Mm-hmm. And particularly, again, for the African-American community, because the trauma is so deep and is so... It's been ongoing. Mm. It's been different iterations of the same illness. Mm. And so there are layers and layers, you know, it's dealing with some of that ancestral trauma that you need to heal from. It's dealing with some of that, you know, the vicarious trauma too, that, you know, even I may not experience it myself, but if I see another African-American woman my age in distress, or being shot by the police or something like that, then I'm affected by that too. Mm. Much like that, something happening to my son. I have an 11-year-old son. If I see that happen to someone's son on TV, I'm going to feel that same way too. I live in a city where Tamir Rice was gunned down by the police. He was 12 when he was shot and killed. My son is 11. That has affected me and how I view my son and how I want him to be perceived in this world. Mm. So those are real stressors that African-American mothers and families in general deal with on a day-to-day basis and have to take into consideration. And so that creates a lot of anger and animosity and within self. And the expression of that, again, can be in different forms. So again, dealing with that trauma is healing and being vulnerable and being able to, you only get to that place of vulnerability through social interconnectedness though. Mm. So that's why that part of who we are is very important. If we can reach people on that level, then we can impact them in very empowering ways. Mm-hmm. Because then we're giving them the not only the tools and the skills, but we're giving them that cushion of support that they're not going on this journey alone either. Mm-hmm. Because we've all been there and we all are suffering essentially from the same trauma. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, if you add on to any personal trauma that you may have experienced within your life, you know, that's up to three types of trauma that African Americans deal with on a daily basis. And so there's no wonder that there's chronic stress there. Mm-hmm. There's no wonder.
That manifests in these physical health issues, particularly in maternal health and childbirth.
Absolutely. I mean, there are things, you know, the other thing too is even with our policies and our laws, because I deal a lot with policy as well in my work, mm-hmm. is we don't have the best family and medical leave act laws. Mm-hmm. We don't make it easy for families to be families. You know, essentially we don't make it easy for people to add to their families. You know, we get 12 weeks unpaid, and that's not realistic for a lot of families. At least that's what the policy is, that your job can give you 12 weeks of unpaid leave. Mm. It just guarantees your job when you get back, but that's not realistic for families.
Who can live without the salary? And then 12 weeks even isn't that long to be bonding with a newborn child or giving that child a really kind of like secure and safe entry into the world.
Absolutely. And so in other countries, a lot of times that is built into their insurance packet, that people, that they'll have a support person after they give birth. And so people here don't have that type of security. You have to be in a, you have to make a certain amount of income to be able to afford a service like that here. So, you know, with our work, our, all of our services are free. Mm. And we have to make a point of that, because without the support, the mothers are likely to have their babies earlier, and that leads to all type of complications that are costly for years to come. You know? So it's, so the bottom line is invest in human capital. Investing in human capital actually grows the economy. You know, I it's okay to be a capitalist society, but at the same time, without the human capital, it won't work as well.
Oh, that's just such a brilliant quote. It's okay to be a capitalist society if we're investing in human capital.
Right.
Yes. So great. You touched a little bit on the kind of like, you know, the yin-yang balance. And I would just love to hear a little about how you involve men and fathers in this process and this work too. We've spoken a lot about sisterhood and women helping women. But how do you kind of like, how do you get the men on board as well?
So we have a fatherhood program. So we are doulas. And so the men, we call them dude-less, like dude-less. So they're, so it's like a mentorship program. And it's meant to be complementary to our classes. However, some of the curriculum comes from us about teaching the men. And it's all men. So we have a project manager who's male, and he runs the classes, and the women aren't involved at all. We help set up and everything, but, you know, they meet separately. And we're on one floor, and then they're on the floor down from us. And we intentionally did it that way so that as they're leaving together, they can have conversation about what they both learned, or, you know, or what was talked about. And that's a bonding moment for them as they prepare for the baby. And, you know, them just prepping. So we actually did a pilot and it went over very well. So then we were just funded to start it back up at the end of this month. So I'm very happy about that. And we did have really good participation from the males.
Mm-hmm. That's really great to hear. That's super encouraging to hear that the dudes, the doodlers are like on board with it too, you know?
Yeah.
Really important. Can you tell me a bit about your future plans? Like before we began recording, you shared some about your sort of big vision, and I'd love to hear about where you want to take this work next, where you are taking this work next.
So Birthing Beautiful Communities, the nonprofit, I certainly would like to show this model and implement this model in other areas across the nation who are facing the same challenges around structural and systemic racism. Cleveland is one of the most segregated cities in the country. I believe we're number three on the list. And so that means, again, that that systemic and structural racism has a lot to do with our outcomes. And so there are other places that are struggling with infant mortality, with maternal mortality, and we believe we certainly have the model to change that and to help that. But we need also the support of the government and the communities around to invest with economic development, business development, and all of those things that are essential to create equity. Because mm-hmm. without creating equity, we are just, you know, we're not getting at the root of the problem. We're mm-hmm. just serving as a program. And programs are not meant to be long-term solutions to long-term issues. Programs are short-term. And so this has to be more of a social movement. This has to be more of, it's unacceptable that babies are dying. Mm. And it has to be more of, you know, it has to be more accountability in that. And a lot of people don't want to talk about equity or race. And so, hey, we have to push past that. But again, our plans is to be able to take this model across the nation, but our more short-term plans around our campus, we are hoping, well, I shouldn't say hoping, but we are planning to build our campus in the Huff neighborhood in Cleveland, Ohio, which is one of the neighborhoods that has the highest infant mortality rate. Not the highest, but one of them. And we want to build our administrative campus there, a birthing center, and 20 units of short-term housing, including a child care center. We do workforce development, so we want to expand our services. We want to train more women to become perinatal support professionals. We want more Black women to become midwives. We want to see more Black lactation consultants. Mm-hmm. When Black women have the lowest breastfeeding rates in the country, we have a severe shortage of birth workers. And educational institutions have to be, to some degree, we have to hold them accountable for creating equity, making education accessible to populations that have been historically and consistently deprived of them. And so, again, people have to be held accountable for implementing equity if we are serious about saving Black babies and Black mothers. Anything other than those things, we blowing smoke, you know?
It's just more band-aids on a wound that is still bleeding.
Absolutely. Yeah. This should be embedded in our society, in our structure, that families are supported after having a baby, period. Mm. That should just be the way of life. Mm. That's what we're pushing for. You know, we think insurance companies, they should cover these services because it's a cost saving. It costs much less to be preventative. Mm-hmm. than it costs for a baby to be in the NICU. It's $3,000 a day for a baby to be in the NICU. Mm. And if you have a baby at 27 weeks, chances are that baby will be in the NICU for at least 10 weeks.
Wow.
So the cost savings for our services is only $4,800 compared to
tens
of thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
We have to get in front of, and that money can be invested into the other areas that are lacking equity. So it's a cycle. Mm. You know, it's pretty much healing. And one of the a professor and researcher here at Cleveland State, you know, and what he talks about is the healing economies, which are preparing. Yeah. So, and that's pretty much what it is. It's sort of this ecosystem, a healing ecosystem around trauma and the African-American experience.
Well, I mean, it's everything that you're doing is such a beautiful example, living, breathing example of exactly that, a healing ecosystem that's really approaching our human problems as a completely holistic system that each and every one of us is actually has some kind of a role in contributing towards healing, you know? Whether it's me here today helping you share this, whether it's you doing the work you do, like every single individual has a role within this. And I think you're right. We can't, until we acknowledge that this problem is all of our problem, we're never going to be able to actually help each other to recover, you know, unless we acknowledge that this trauma is all of our trauma, actually.
And the truth is, everyone is traumatized by even the experience of African Americans in this country, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's not even about only healing African Americans, mm-hmm. but it's about healing our society as a whole, mm-hmm. because the act of denial, you know, the act of, you know, not acknowledging these things or living or in privilege and that sort of thing, those things have to be healed too, because there has to become a shift. There's a shift to have a new normal. And no one knows how to live in that new normal yet.
Because we haven't invented it yet.
We haven't invented it yet. And so that's where that fear comes from. Mm. That's why we see so much fear-based, and politics and else and everywhere else, because people are running away from acknowledging the truth. It's too painful, it's too uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Though it's not there to shame anyone, because not one person alive today is responsible for slavery. Mm. So no one, you know, it doesn't pay. You are not helping any situations by being guilty or feeling ashamed. That doesn't serve a purpose in this.
Because that also totally disempowers you and leaves you unable to act and contribute.
Absolutely. So that's why I say no one across racial lines, it shouldn't be much the guilt and shame. That bears no progress or no weight for the mission at hand.
So speaking of the mission at hand, I think it would be great to hear if you have any advice for somebody who's maybe feeling called to take action within their community at this kind of grassroots level, but is maybe feeling like it's an overwhelming task, or they don't really know where to start, or they don't necessarily have the skills or the support to be able to start doing something on of their own. What kind of advice would you give for anybody who wants to really kind of engage in this sort of grassroots activism?
I say focus on you and focus on your goal, and the right people will align with you to support you in the way that you need to be supported at that particular time to move you to the next goal. And it's okay to not have everything planned out. And even if you do have everything planned out, plans go awry. Mm-hmm. So plan for the bigger vision and then work backwards to see where you can plant your seed, and the connections and relationships that you need, they will come to you. Because when you are working in your passion and in your work, people are attracted to you. And they will help you along that path as they also believe in your mission and your vision. And you also have to be able to connect with people and always be a diplomat as well. I always tell people, always be a diplomat when talking or speaking to anybody. That will carry you far with your relationships and connections.
Mm. And just help those essential relationships to grow and develop faster, and ultimately help you carry out your mission too.
Absolutely. I have a somewhat, I guess, compelling story, because I went to work at a community development corporation before I founded this organization. I worked at a community development corporation for about 5 years. But during that time, I had to work with a lot of different institutions and organizations, and I just met so many people. So when I began building Birth and Beautiful Communities, I had a lot of the connections and relationships already. And those people were people who also wanted to support this, you know, mm-hmm. that we were doing that around infant mortality. So again, we started off with a very small grant. We started off with $4,200, and we grew that, you know, we've grown that into almost $3 million in 3 years. And that is because the energy of the people, they feel so good about helping one another. You know, energy travels. That, you know, that energy is very real. And so the women are very happy about the work that they're doing, and the other families, they're happy about the services that they're receiving. And so they tell everyone about us, and they want everyone else to experience what it feels like as well. So again, when you're doing the right thing and when you are walking in alignment with your path, everything that you need will be drawn to you.
I love it. Thank you. That's such an inspiring end note. And I love the fact that you've managed to grow $4,200 to 3 million in 3 years. That's incredible work and just, yeah, so inspiring. Thank you again, Kristen, for joining me to speak, to tell us your story today and speak about the work that you do and really just kind of like help us all to confront some of the bigger issues that are underlying the problems faced in your communities, and help us all understand our responsibility in taking our part in healing too. I thank you. Good luck with everything that you're doing. I'm going to include all of the links to your work, to your fundraising initiatives, and to your expansion plans in the show notes for this. So thank you again.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate you reaching out to us, and thank you for having me on.
I am so grateful to Kristen for taking the time to tell us about her work and for helping to open my eyes even more as to the true daily impact of institutionalized racism, for reminding me again that this is something we all have to play our part in healing. If you're inspired to support her, there's a link to donate to Birthing Beautiful Communities in the show notes, and this will be much appreciated as Kristen is gearing up to open a second center this spring. Thanks again for tuning in, and I'll see you next time. This podcast features original music and is edited by alloaudio.com, www.alloaudio.com.